I've got half an hour, and I'm in trouble if I go over half an hour, so I'm going to have to watch what I say or speak really fast. So required reading for today is two life stories of Tamasanva. There's these Tibetan life stories which kind of get discovered in Tibet years after Tamasanva appeared and did his teaching and everything. And they form the basis of the stories that we know, and they're wild and wonderful things. That one's got three different versions in it, and this has got one I'll be reading from. Other required reading is The Gruffalo. Yeah, very important reading for this subject. Classic Fairy Tales by Iona and Peter Bopit. That's he got it back from America. Yeah, you need to know about that. I need to know about The Worlds of Patrick Geddes. Right? So he was one of my heroes. He was a late 1800s, early 1900s sort of evolutionist who got into town planning. And he would understand Edinburgh and the improvements of Edinburgh by knowing everything. Geology, agriculture, religion, society, economy, everything about Edinburgh. Then you'd know if you could shift a house this much or not. Yeah. And then his improvements, is like, it would have saved a lot of the 20th century if you'd listened to him. He thought the word synergy, synthesis, synergy. Sympathy, synthesis, synergy. Feeling together for each other. Thinking together and acting together. Yep, that's probably enough. Oh, and this is a picture I found today as well. Jennifer Angson, who years ago, when he gave us the very first Padmasambhava Day talk I came to, he had a t-shirt like this, and he talked about this is a Japanese demon. He said, if he can meditate, we can. Yeah? And it's not like this big ugly monster sitting there with his big fangs and his horns. And he's just put in the club from walloping somebody, but he's sitting meditating. And for me, that was a turning point in my whole practice. So, let's get going. Why Padmasambhava? If you look at the FWO's refuge tree, there's all these historical figures in the kind of hinterland, as it were, of our spiritual tradition where we stand. And there's 16 or 18 of them, and Padmasambhava's only one of them, but we get a whole day to do a festival for him. And why would this be? I think partly because we're just following on from Sangharakshita's footsteps. It's important to him, this figure, and we take on. Also, there's two lectures you can look up on Free Buddhist Audio, numbers 111 and 151. It's like Chinese menu order. But if you put in Padmasambhava, you'll get these coming up. And they focus on one particular event in this personage's life stories. And this event is that of Tibet becoming Buddhist, the king of Tibet introducing Buddhism, and they build a big temple and start teaching and something like this. Each night the demons come out and demolish the temple, and the next day they start again, and the demons come out and demolish the temple, and they start again, and the demons march up down the streets with big loud drums, and they come and they knock the temple back down. And Bansi's pointing at this. This point is something quite central. It's quite central to what we're doing. And it's trying to establish the Dharma, trying to establish Buddhist practice in our lives, and trying to establish it in this society. Yeah? And it feels like that a lot of the time, doesn't it? You make an effort, you come off retreat, you get particularly inspired in a course, it's going to make great strides, and then the things you're not even aware of conspire to take all the bricks back down again. So for that reason, Bhakti says in my lectures, what Padmasambhava represents is very crucial. Yeah. It's not an exotic interest in what's happening in Tibet, but it's a symbol for what's happening with us in our lives. It speaks directly to our situation. So let's see. So let's tease it out. Yeah. Here's one of the many life stories of Padmasambhava. So Tristan Detson is a king, and he's a very powerful king, and he wants to get civilized. As I always say, it's a bit like King Louis in the Jungle Book. He's got to the top, had to stop, and that's what's bothering me. So what he has to do is he wants to go further. So he wants to learn the secrets of the boy child, doesn't he? He wants to learn this thing called fire. Tristan Detson has got to the top of the Tibetans, and he wants to copy these civilized cultures that he's been invading, like India and China, and he wants Buddhism. So he invites in Santarachita, who is a bodhisattva abbot. The foundation was laid, and they began to build. but powerful male and female yaksha spirits of Tibet, such as the 21 Gen Yen and others, began to create obstacles. What the king's men built by daylight, the spirits destroyed and levelled each night. Thus, the construction could not progress. Master Bodhisattva, that's this great scholar, then said, "It seems to me that the construction cannot be completed." King Trusandetsen asked, "Isn't there something that can be done?" Master Bodhisattva replied, "Great king, I know all the teachings of the causal philosophical vehicles without exception, and I have mastered bodhicitta, that's compassion, but it looks as though I have not yet tamed the savage and malicious gods and spirits. Still, there is something to do." Okay, the stages in this. This is a big transformation point in conversion and the Tibetan culture shifting. If you go back 100 years before that, you've got a king called Songtsen Gampo. And what he did was he married a Nepalese princess and a Chinese princess. And they were quite strong characters. They kept having fights with each other and controlling the king. And I think the Nepalese got their way. They sent this really powerful daughter up. And she sorted out the king. And the Chinese were having trouble with Tibetan, so they sent her, she'll sort him out too. And they're controlling a situation, and they build a Chinese and Nepalese type temple with a beautiful Chinese statue inside. But the rest of Tibet stays Tibetan. Yeah? So it's the first phase, it's the exotic phase of getting involved in something dharmic. For us, it's like the stage when we have these little books of the Dalai Lama saying relax, and it's we get into singing bowls. And we get into kind of those lovely little postcards. What was that one we were looking at? The two Tibetan gentlemen bumping their heads together and say something about friendship. You know, it's like, why isn't it two women working Greggs bumping their heads together? So, you know, but because it's these Tibetan guys in their Sunday best, it's like, oh, that's really meaningful, isn't it? It's that phase of exotic. Yeah, it's what happens when you come here once a week or so, and Buddhism happens here. The rest of your life is just like the Tibetans; it's outside of that. It's an exotic thing that it's like Zen interior decor, isn't it? It's that new colour that's taken over from Magnolia. Gardenia, is it? That's a Zen colour. You have a gardenia and you've got lots of lovely driftwood and sand colours and bare wood. And it's quite lovely, it's quite good. But the rest of your life is business as normal. Yeah? The rest of your life is unchanged as it was for the Tibetans. It's important this phase is not bad. Yeah? It's part of a path. Part of a progress, and a stage is only kind of goes wrong, yeah, not inherently wrong, but goes wrong when it stops there, because every phase of getting deeper into the Dharma will lead to it going deeper. Yeah, so something about that phase of getting interested in the sort of, you love the exoticism, it's dressed up in nice robes, it's dressed up this way and that way, and it doesn't go any deeper, it's like it will start to take you deeper. If you resist that and stay in the shallow, then that's when it sticks. But as itself, it's a perfectly viable phase. So the Tibetans, that was good enough for them for 100 years. It was bonpo rituals and sacrifices and black magic and brigandship as usual, with a nice temple in the middle, a Nepalese Chinese temple sitting in the middle of it. 100 years later, Trusandetsen takes it further. He brings in Santarakshita. He teaches ethics. He teaches the wheel of life. He teaches the way we perceive experience. Quite sort of ethical, rational, sensible stuff. Yeah? And things go mad. Yeah? Everyone's the stir up. The local ministers, the traditional old families are in riot. Yeah? The bonpo priests are trying to protest, are trying to either kill this Santarakshita or get him out of the country. The very demons of the country are rising up and killing and taking things apart. So for us, this is a stage we take it seriously. Yeah? And we come off that retreat or we come off that course where things bite a bit deeper, and usually when things stir up is when we make changes. It's usually when we give something up, isn't it? So if you look at the demons, what are the demons and the gods are the tribal rituals, the tribal habits. You do a sacrifice at this shrine, you worship this mountain because it's got to do with your great grandfather. It's the kind of patterns of life that we have, and change has happened, especially the ethical change has happened and start biting, and that is cutting against. Yeah. For a lot of Buddhist practice, on the exotic, on the kind of easy consumer level, you won't get this stir up, it won't go deep enough. But if you take it a bit more seriously, bingo. Yeah. So it's our ancestral rituals, our cultural patterns, meet and change. So classic ones is giving up eating meat. Yeah. I remember sitting there like 20 years old, And I was given that week because I was now a Buddhist, and I was at my family's table, and my father's job and his father's job and his father's father's job was a beef farm and a sheep farm. And it was like, luckily I was young enough to be rebellious. So at that age, it's like, well, I make this, that. And it was like my parents were like glooming. It was the ancestors glooming over you. Yeah. It was my grandfathers and everything they'd struggled for. Here was I not eating their culture. Or it's giving up alcohol. It's like, you can't hang out in the pub with your pals anymore. Can you do that? You know, if you're taking this step, a little glass of wine after a meal. So it's like your Buddhism's giving up something and it's meeting resistance. You want to go on a retreat, but your tribe, your family has got the annual holiday. There's this event, that event, a cousin's wedding or something. And it's like clash, you know. And it's not just your own little inner gods, it's like your family gods and your cultural gods. Yeah. That's the third term. So the question is, what is our ancestral gods look like? Yeah? Are they a minister? Or the, what's it, for Catholic, there's that little wind up, you ever seen this nunzilla, this little wind up nun that's got a ruler and its sparks come out. I think the model's Godzilla, but they just put a nun on the top and it goes for some of us, that's what we've got. Yeah, it's a Jewish mother, or it's that grandfather that reads the Guru Granth Sahib or something, isn't it? It's like reading this and standing up these traditions. It's whoever's there at your shoulder when you're sitting in here saying, what are you doing here? You're sitting in the shrine room and all this stuff, making you feel that. It's your ancestors who have, and the gods who don't, haven't made that, they haven't joined in. Yeah. And we've made a move and they haven't joined in. You know, is it a suffragette? Yeah. Is it a socialist miner saying, look at you, that's the opiate of the people, why are you involved in this? You know, you should be out there helping people, struggling for the grassroots, you know, that ancestor back there it's the life behind us, our blood, our family. Yeah. So that's some of the demons, some of the gods, isn't it? So here's another one. You understand this. This is straightforward. So there's this Gyalpo. That's the male Tibetan deity. Represents anger, arrogance, and a touch of jealousy. Jealousy is the opposite of love and compassion. It arises when you see that someone is successful and you wish they would not be so happy. Such emotions are represented by the Gyalpo, which is Tibetan for king. Perhaps it's because kings are typically arrogant and want to be the best and most important of all. The female one, the Tsenmo, represents grasping attachment and discontent, and arises when you feel that something is always missing and things are never good enough, and then you grasp all the more tightly. This mental attitude is represented by the Tsenmo demon. Yeah. Do these ring bells? Have you dropped the word demon? Mm-hmm. Both of them as in all of us. Yeah. So that's that force. Yeah. Yeah, it's a clash with Tibetan psyche. Yeah. So you get into your Buddhism, and it stirs things up, doesn't it? It clashes deep habitual patterns, like the romantic relationship. You hold that at the highest. If you get involved in Buddhism, that starts to question that. My rights, it's not fair. I am a failure. My career. We've got all these little shrines, inner shrines that we maintain. We put a lot of time and effort into keeping them going. I'm rubbish, I'm rubbish. We offer incense to it, we sacrifice things to it. Or, I can make it, I'm great. You know. Beauty, youth, family values, money, that's a good one. Health, beauty, style. And then we've got physical shrines, haven't we? In our house, you know, what is the most tended to part of our house? It's a beautiful kitchen, all shining and gleaming and new. Is it the bed? You know, it's like got the best covers and lovely things arranged around it. Like a rich, opulent bed we put into it. Or a TV. Is that the altar? You know? In our house, we've got this TV, and I've got a chair, so the middle-aged chap's chair that sits, and I sit in it. And in front of me is a TV, and behind me is my shrine. Yeah. And it's like, if I move my chair around, I can sit and meditate at my shrine. And it's quite embarrassing, the proportion of ways that chair's pointing. Which shrine? Bigger shrines, like, and we sacrifice things to them, don't we? Like the Tibetans, they would sacrifice animals and all sorts of things to these gods, these altars. It's like we're getting it publicly, collectively, we're sacrificing our public services to the altar of unregulated free market, aren't we? Free market's gone completely wrong, banks have cost a fortune, so we've just spent all our family blank money, put it all into keeping that going. So we're closing the next year, hospitals will go, this will go, services will go. It's like things are sacrificed to what we hold most important. So there's tension, there's conflict. In Tibet, there's almost a civil war. And in us, there's tension. Yeah. And that's uncomfortable. So there's two responses. The Tibetans can either exile Santarakshita. They managed to get him to have to leave for a bit. But he says, bring in Padmasambhava. Right? So there's two ways we can go. Back off, back to the exotic level, the comfortable level, or on into inviting another level of practice, engaging at a deeper level. Yeah, we can back off the exotic level. Yeah. One way we can do that is we can move on to another spiritual tradition. Yeah. If we want to stay shallow, we want to stay exotic, you have to keep changing. It's like if you want to keep a relationship shallow and fun, you have to keep changing partners. Because yeah. After a year, they start making demands, and it gets more difficult. You have to change. And the same with any thing we pick up. But if we keep moving, we try Zen this week, shamanism next year, keep moving, we can stay shadow, we can stay that exotic land. But if we stay with anyone for any length of time, then we come to the same position where we have to engage more, where we waken up. So we can make a compromise. Yeah. We can sort of like just make a comfortable corner for a bit of Buddhism, a little temple, and back to the rest being just business as usual. Or we can change tactic. Yeah. We can broaden and deepen the practice. Because for some of us in this tension, it's too late, isn't it? We're invited in, we're the city of Troy, we're invited in the horse, and the Greeks have popped at the bottom and starting to take things apart. There's no way back. We've fallen in love with the Dharma, we've fallen in love with what we've learned, what the effect it's had on us. We can't back off, we can't move to the shallow. So Padmasambhava gets invited in. So he's a bit like when you've got somebody building and doing something to your house and it goes a bit wrong. And the old boss has to turn up to clear up the mess that the boys have been doing. You know that situation you've ever been in? Where it's like things are not going right. And the old boss comes and has to, oh, what the hell's happened now? And he has to come in and go, oh, you've done that. Right? And he sacks a few of them. This is Padmasambhava. He's the master. He comes in. Bill was telling me about his favourite programme. What is it? The Dog Whisperer?
Yes.
Yeah, and the guy's called?
Cesar Millan,
right. I even watched a bit of this just because Bill and Sarah Jai are experts with dogs. You know, they really know how to work with dogs, and this is their favourite programme. So every week there's a dog which is in a terrible state, and the whole house is in complete uproar. It's peeing and everything, it's biting everything, it's sitting up on the table. And in comes Cesar Millan and sorts it out. Yeah, he's a master of the dogs, and he kind of, what is it? He says, he gets bitten by a bulldog and goes, oh, just a few love bites. It's like nothing scares him. Yeah. He knows the dog inside out, and by the time he's finished, he's trained the dog, but even more importantly, he's trained the people. And everyone's happy. The dog's a dog, the people are people, everyone's in their place, and they're all working harmoniously. That's what Padmasambhava does. He comes in, and he speaks the language of the demons and the gods. Yeah. He's not trying to reason with them. You know, like, you try to reason with a dog, man, that's not a very good thing to do, is it? You know, you have to reason with a dog as a dog, as a dog. Yeah. And he comes in, and he speaks the language of demons, which is as follows. So, Padmasambhava comes into the country, and interestingly, he doesn't go straight to the headquarters, to the capital. He walks around, and one of the images goes, he places his foot on every inch of the country. Yeah? He stands in and walks on every part of Tibet. He knows it from the roots up. And he goes around, and what he does is this. Afterward, when going on to the valley of Chimpu Shampo, Karla Shampo manifested himself as a big demon, as a white yak the size of a mountainside, with his nose streaming like assembled clouds, his roar like thunder, and his breath storming like a blizzard. He brought down lightning and hail. He then assumed a formidable stance. Master Padma caught the yak by the nose with the hook gesture, bound his middle with the lasso gesture, laid his legs in shackles with the chain gesture, and beat and hacked him with the bell gesture, a bit stronger than Chisarda, isn't it? There we go. By different times. By that, Yarla Shampo turned into a young boy with white silken braids. He offered the core of his life and was bound under oath. Next, Master Padma proceeded to Sky Plain of Lhasa, where Tangla imposed his presence upon the master, manifesting himself as an enormous yaksha, big demon thing. He approached, attempting to swallow up the master. When Padma made a threatening gesture, Tangla turned into a child with turquoise locks and was bound under oath, Master Padma said, "Listen, here's the one called White Skull Naga Forefather, or Five-Braided Gandharva King. No small creature. Sometimes he is known as Nying Cheng Tangla. I must fetch him a meal." Saying this, he left. Around the evening time, he returned carrying some tasteless flat cookies and various other foods in the fold of his sleeve. Thus, he brought Tangla under his command. And what he does, he doesn't kill them. He doesn't do the St. Patrick banishing snakes, or St. George killing the dragon, or was it St. Basil that flattened the entire sacred grove? What he does is he gets them on the side of Buddhism and gives them a teaching to look after. Gives them a secret teaching, and they protect that teaching. So they come in with practice. He learns a language and he brings them into practice. Cutting down sacred groves, isn't it? If you think, to get into this, we have to plant our sacred groves again. We've lost that. The modern West, by and large, has got an arid monoculture. It must be the only culture ever, probably, that doesn't really worship much, apart from ourselves. It doesn't worship much else. So it's like we're working like right the basics of bringing this back in. And the gods have been exiled, ignored, and exorcised, and they've become demons, haven't they? What is the phrase? Demon est deus inversus. A demon is a god turned upside down. If you ignore, if you push out, if you're sitting that figure behind you of your ancestors that says, "What are you doing here?" If you pretend that's not happening, and you sit in your shallow, "I'm a nice Buddhist," it gets nasty. It starts messing about under the covers, under in the dark. The demons that take the city apart, the temple apart, do it at night when it's dark. In the rational, reasonable day, we're all good Buddhists building a temple. At night, the unconscious, what we don't know, it's like, woohoo. The reasonable, rational, materialist Glasgow we have, isn't it? And we go out shopping, and it's all quite sensible, and we just meet the face of some heroin addicts, all these guys, these scary 40s, it's like, a guy got the nice West End. And somebody's wandered down from those bits north of the West End that I don't see. And it's like, I go, "Oh, there's a whole underbelly, there's a whole side of Glasgow that in my nice little West End I don't see." It erupts in, isn't it? We think the Victorians, you know, the nice family values and like a roaring trade and prostitution underneath in the Whitechapel, usually, isn't it? All these dark lanes and everything. But we've got our version. This bit, we don't see it and it goes mad. Yeah. There's madness just around every corner. What's that? The thing that really bugs me, I'm obsessed by it. It's a pink stretched Humvee. Have you seen this thing? And it patrols the city. And it looks like fun. But then you think, hang on, that's a military machine. That's used. They use them to drive the staff to Abu Ghraib with the tortures. You know, they use these to drive people to do the day's work, blowing up Fallujah or whatever. And it's done up like gangster style. And gangster culture is about two things. It's selling heroin and being a pimp. And it's like, this thing is embodying the nastiest bits of our culture. Militarism, drug addiction, prostitution, violence. Driving about as entertainment. I just stare at this thing and go, "Oh my God." And it's guzzling, isn't it? The thing's like, Humvee must take about, is it 8 miles to the gallon? This thing's like 3 long. Yeah? To me, this is Glasgow's underbelly demon patrolling. Dun, 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 dun. It's round the streets. Is it just me? 24 minutes, right, keep it going.
5 more minutes. 6.
Padmasambhava knows the languages, yeah? And that's what we need to learn. Santarakshita, his language was its proper Buddhism. Padmasambhava wants to get his proper Buddhism going, but he has to do a bit of groundwork first. Yeah? He has to start right at the roots. He has to walk every inch of the terrain. He has to get deeper and broader than Santarakshita's predominantly conceptual language. So what's our languages, right? Here's 4 minutes of it, it's going really fast. Pay attention. We're going to replant the sacred grove. We've got to do that business first, which he didn't have to do because the grove was up and running. And we've got to learn to speak the language of that. One, us and our body. Yeah? So no body, no practice. What's the Yorkshire phrase? No shoe, no horse, isn't it? So no body, no practice. And it's like, I've tried to do this all for 26 years, but Sanganaksha set up the FWO with yoga and Tai Chi in it, for good reason. And eventually I have to do this, or maybe there's something in this. But it's like, that's why we started today with Hibashi Qigong. Yeah, and it's like, you're just not ignoring the body, you're embodying yourself, yeah? all this stuff, focusing, counselling, breath works, mindfulness based work with depression, all of it, right? It's not so much you're establishing a healthy foundation for practice, but you're establishing a healthy foundation of practice. Yeah? And if it's not working, if your Buddhism is, your temples have been knocked down every night, go back and start there. Go back and start very basic things. Yeah. Yeats verse, labour is blossoming or dancing where the body is not bruised to pleasure soul, nor beauty born out of its own despair, nor blear-eyed wisdom out of midnight oil. O chestnut tree, great-rooted blossomer, are you the leaf, the blossom, or the bowl? O body swaying to music, O brightening glance, how can we know the dancer from the dance? Mm-hmm. Yeah. We don't get that option. We can't do soul rather than body. Yeah. A Buddhist does a whole lot. Next emphasis of Sangharakshitas, collectivity, friendship, Sangha. Yeah. It's taking Sangha practice deeper than the polite pleasantries. Yeah. It's taking us into situations where we bump into each other, we fall out, we have huge arguments, we go through, and harmony isn't, as we always say, isn't the avoidance of conflict, it's a resolution. And in that, we build trust. We build situations where we work enough together, we live enough together, we're deep enough together, that we meet each other. And we don't just meet the sides we want to present, the bits we'd like to be. Yeah. We bump into each other as we are and rough up the rough and tumble. Thich Nhat Hanh's thing for the Sangha, it's like, how you clean chopsticks is you rub them up against each other and the bits come off. Yeah. That's how you do Sangha. So that's moving deeper into that. The language of that is the language of friendship, of spending time practicing as a Sangha. Otherwise, we're in the exoticism, aren't we? We're in the weekly nice chat, the shallow level. Culturally, building a sense of place, history, refining and deepening our feelings, yeah, deepening our sense of beauty. I think this is one of the Sangharakshita bits I listen to. I kind of, a bit done the collectivity, I've had to do that, and I kind of ignored the exercise bit, but I think I get better marks for this bit, right? William Stafford poem, I love this. Time wants to show you a different country. It's the one that your life conceals. The one waiting outside when curtains are drawn. The one grandmother hinted at in her crochet design. The one almost found over at the edge of the music after the sermon. So, if we were to get into all these gods, Tibetan style, even if we were to get into Thor and Diana and all these ancient pagan things, Western style, for most of us, most of the time, it would probably be exoticism. Yeah. But we've got the way in, we've got the language of all that much more immediately, much more directly. Yeah. Read poetry. Yeah. Let the words open you up and go deep into the words. Yeah. Take a line of Yeats and just let that one word, all the meanings, you're learning a language, straightforward English language, just open up that much richer. Yeah. Go to the Kelvin Grove Art Gallery and look at paintings. Go and learn what winter, Scottish winter light's like from the Glasgow boys. Yeah. Or the colour, the Minch from Peplo and Cadell. They're over there waiting, right? And they'll just teach you that language to see that. Listen to music. We would argue all night about what good music is, right? But it's not death metal, you're going to be surprised. Mahler, Sibelius, Coltrane. Yeah. And look upwards next time you walk down Hope Street. Yeah. See the Victorian decorations. Amazing stuff up there. There's a Michelangelo, David, on top of a building in sandstone. Yeah. Get into that, get into the Victorian decoration, fight minimalist functionalism, yeah. Enjoy the old stuff, yeah. And find out what Rotten Row means, where that word's come from, yeah. Find out who Clutha is, yeah, because you're standing in her basin, yeah, the goddess of the climb. Find out about her, yeah. Walk the landscape, yeah, and locate its history. Maureen was embarrassing me by talking about the Paisley Art Gallery having brilliant Paisley patterns and shawls, and I thought, oops, I'm going to talk about this and I've never been. And it's like, you should be there, shouldn't you? It's got a medieval abbey. It's like one of the nexuses for the whole of what Strathclyde is, it's growing out of. Here's Alan Moore, one of my heroes. He writes graphic novels. Everywhere that we live is surrounded by these fascinating fragments of history. They are embedded in it. These fantastic vanishing personalities, these legends, these romances. These things, though they are embedded in the past, are very much a part of the fabric of all of our lives. And if we wish to live in that world of legend, rather than in this somewhat sorry and appalling tabloid world which we have had dished up to us, then we have to be prepared to excavate. We have to be prepared to look below the surface of our lives and find that rich coal seam of meaning and history that underlies our entire experience. So becoming wholly engaged in practice, yeah, so that when you read a sutra or when you meditate, everything is involved. Yeah. It's like you read a sutra and just a little shiny, tiny bit of you involved and you're bored with it. But what it takes is to go back and pick up more of you and come back and read it again. What was that G.G. Chesterton quote I loved? He talked about the Christian ideal is not so much being tried and found wanting as found difficult and not really tried at all. And that's the same with everything, culture and all religions. So it's like, find it difficult, try it again. Yeah. And pick up more and more yourself with this, learning these languages. Lama San was engaging more and more with Tibetan culture, picking up more and more of the psyche, more and more of the culture, more and more of the history, and bringing it into practice. And then, when you sit, yeah, when you do puja in this way, when you chant a mantra in this way, you meditate in this way, your body sits to your heart, your language, myth, culture, ancestors, the very geology sits with you. Yeah? When you sit and meditate, the camps you sit in, the Calton Hills, you're sitting in this total mandala, fully present. Yeah? And the hindering demons, then, gradually, are converted, they're inverted back into helpful gods. And it's this transformation that Padmasambhava represents. Yeah? This is the reason that we celebrate it. This is the reason why it's so important. Just to finish with that ending of the reading we did earlier today. Don't mistake mere words to be the meaning of the teachings. Mingle the practice with your own being and attain liberation right now.